Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. We are experimenting tonight. We've kind of repaired some things on our end here, and we've readjusted some settings just now. That's I'm a little bit late, so that you will hear me more clearly than ever, we hope. Seems like there were some wires that were a little frayed here and there, and certain things are kind of worn and not working right. And we have hopefully corrected them from last week's show. Sorry if you were having trouble hearing me last week. You should be hearing me better, clear and loud. But we're still adjusting things as we go through the show, and we will see how the whole thing works out. Now we have to make new settings because the old ones have changed. Tonight's show, I thought we would talk about the physics of love. Of course, this is a show about metaphysics, physics, science in general, and God, usually, and it's many other things. It's about why life is, of course, but it is, even more than that, a show that deals with just about anything and everything that fits within how people think of why we're here. And so this is an important, I would say, general show on oncology, if you know what that is. Ontology, I should say, not oncology. Oncology is for people interested in cancer, but ontology is the study of the nature of God and how it relates to our universe. And then cosmology, which is just the nature of how the universe is created, whether you believe in God or not. And so we put these together and we kind of come up with this show. Tonight, the physics of love is about what is love, how does it work as far as a science, and can it be defined? Many people would think it can't be, but I'm going to do so coming up right now. How can it be defined in terms of physics, and consequently somewhat metaphysically as well? So to start with, let me explain this. Love is really the second part of the three parts of God's or our Creator's mind. It has to do with the direction of choices that we make, the direction of thought, that's another way to look at it, and the connection of those choices so that we can have an understanding of what the choices are about, so that we can be more unified between ourselves and anyone else or anything else. So love is like, how is it that we are similar to and connected to and unified to anything and everything else in the universe? To do that, we need to understand how anything and everything else functions, thinks, feels, and beyond that is in connection to how we are. Once we are able to put all that together, which is a wonderful thing, we have what love is. And it's a great thing. Some people say, well, all those things are love. But yeah, love is inclusiveness, it's understanding, it's direction of thought, it's the part of God that makes us all into one. It brings oneness to the universe. Because otherwise, without it, there could be life, but it wouldn't be connected. And our ability to connect to God, our own Creator, would be impossible. So love is really a very critical element in the universe. And it's one of the three parts of God's mind. Some people refer to it as second ray type. Well, that ray is how love affects energy. So yeah, it's represented within the second ray, but that's not the most critical way to define it. It's sort of like a subway of defining it. Many people consider love some kind of emotional sensation, and that's true too. As a matter of fact, love is the more feminine aspect to God because the first part of God's mind is masculine. The second part is feminine, and the third part is masculine in a completely different and new way that is more than just thought itself. It is action, and especially interaction, very important interaction. So when we are trying to understand the three parts of God's mind, we need to realize that two of the three parts, strangely, or maybe not so much so, are actually more masculine than feminine. There's a slight, we'll call it more than slight, there's a definite tendency for God to be expressed more often than not in a masculine way than in a feminine. Now, is that some kind of anti-feminine thing? No, not at all. It's just that there are four parts to God in its expression in the universe, and four parts, that are male, and three parts that are female. Now, what do I mean by that? The four parts of God that are male, which is the first, the third, the fifth, and the seventh part, forms dimensions of time and space where life can grow itself. That's pretty cool. So there's four parts where life can grow itself that are more masculine than feminine, and there are three parts that are more feminine than masculine where life can grow itself. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that the dimension itself is more favorable. It's easier for life to grow in three out of seven parts of the universe that we call dimensions of time and space. And there are four parts that are easier for the masculine side. So you put them all together. You've got this intertwining, I call it, sort of like one dimension is masculine, and then between that dimension and the next, there's a feminine dimension that is a little easier for feminine kinds of life. Okay, then you say, well, what does masculinity and femininity have to do with dimensionality? And the answer to that has to do with, okay, you ready for this? It has to do with the direction of the spin of the dimension. For those of you familiar with quantum physics, you may recognize that spin is a very important quality in quantum physics. And yes, as that was discovered almost 100 years ago now, the issue of spin is really an issue of masculinity and femininity in some respects. Wow. And then the direction of spin is more than just in, we'll call it left and right. It also has other features. Okay, I'll turn it down. I just heard from the engineer, and he says that we're having some static here, so I'm turning down the sound. I don't know that this is going to actually work. We're going to keep working on it. I hope that's going to work. I'm going to look at my board more and see if I can see anything that looks like it's not working quite right. Okay, we will continue. So, when we have a direction in spin, we can really identify whether there's masculine or femininity, and vice versa. And also, if it's above or below dimensionally where the direction is, there's actually another kind of spin. Think of it from upside and downside direction that also determines some element of masculinity and femininity.
bbsradio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge. Bringing humanity closer to truth.
Okay, we're back on, and I heard back from the engineer, I switched everything over to another whole section of my board. I have this kind of big, funky thing in front of me that has a lot of different switches and dials and things. And I think that one of the whole sections is got some kind of problem in it. So I went ahead and switched it all over to a whole other side. And hopefully I sound good to all of you right now. And if that's true, I'm going to keep talking. I know there was some distortion at the beginning. So let's continue on. And I'll try to make this all work. All right? And the engineer will also let me know if there's a problem going on. So, back to the physics of love. Without getting any more difficult than where I was already at, I'll try to make it even simpler. So we have three parts to God's mind. They are choices. They are direction to those choices, sometimes called understanding and inclusiveness, etc. And then last, the third part to God's mind is the interaction of all of the elements of God, which is life itself. So everything that interacts, everything that has some type, takes some kind of action, and usually works through either in fully intelligent action or some type of energy. Fully intelligent action does not require energy, and everything else that doesn't have fully intelligent interaction has to use some form of energy. These are the three parts of God's mind. They are represented in four ways that are masculine and three ways that are feminine. Okay, everybody with me on this so far? They're interlaced between each other. So the first way, the highest way, is masculine. Next way is feminine. Next way is masculine. So those would represent the first three dimensions of time and space of our universe, sometimes called the logoic plane, divine plane. The highest plane of our universe, the highest dimension, is masculine. Then some people call it the monadic plane or plane of one is feminine. Then the next plane is spiritual. That's where spirit and energy separate from a being called the monad, and you end up with the spiritual, that's masculine again. And then you have the fourth plane or dimension, that's called the intuitional. Some people prefer the word Buddhic, like Buddha from Buddha. And that is a feminine plane, that's the fourth plane, fourth dimension. The fifth dimension, which is masculine again, is the monastic or mental dimension. Okay, you with me on that? Hopefully you are. Now we're in the planes where humans exist. That's the mental starts where humans think and can live. And then the sixth plane, sixth dimension of time and space, is the astral or emotional dimension. That's a feminine dimension. You see how they intertwine one on top of the other? And then finally, the last dimension of time and space, where we exist right now, where the focus is on consciousness. Wow, cool. And in this dimension of time and space is also where it is most difficult to have our senses work, because in each dimension we're going down lower, it's becoming more and more dense. The seventh dimension is considered masculine again, okay? But it is mostly controlled by not only the first part of God's mind, but even more so by the third part of God's mind, where energy is so dense here that intelligent activity becomes the dominant element to whether or not a being can stay alive, because everything we're talking about is about life. Why life is? Well, so that God can grow. God grows more when the life that it initially took in its own beingness to create by its sacrificing many parts of its own life to give to the new life that it helped to create. That's us. It includes us. We're the first part of life that can recognize what I just said, so we can recognize God. Pretty cool, yeah. And where we live right now is dominated by the physics of not just love, but the physics of a more masculine expression of love than in the other dimensions of time and space. Now, we also have bodies. We have bodies that are connected more to the dimensions other than the physical. Our physical body is here, but the other two bodies that we have are connected to the astral, or the sixth dimension. It's a more feminine body. It has a spin in the opposite direction. And to the monastic, which is, again, mental in its focus, it spins the same direction as the physical dimension we're in right now. Yet that dimension is dominated more by the first part of God's mind than the third. Here we're dominated more by the third part of God's mind. Remember, that third part of God's mind is mostly about energy. So the physics of love, as we would expect, has to do a great deal with energy, especially in the dimension we're in. Now, that kind of confuses some people, and it makes for a misunderstanding, because most people think of love as a more emotional element, but yet they're controlled, because they're physically alive, by the energy of love more often than by the, we'll call it, the true physics of love. In its native form, it's more emotional, it's more feminine than it is masculine. But while we're physically alive, we're more affected by the physical side of things and by the energy. What is the energy of love? Well, part of the energy of love is called sex, or sexuality. Sex is the ability to give, which is what love is about. Remember, it's about giving. It's about understanding. It's about being inclusive with, being one with others. So it's the ability to give, in this case, energy to someone else for their sake, for their benefit, if it's like God is. Or we don't give, we take from others energy for our own benefit, and then we're not thinking of or being like our Creator. So that kind of love is kind of anti-love, and it's more of an emotional and, in the physical world, a taking of energy from others than it is of giving. So that's one of the components about the physics of love, while we're physically alive, that causes a lot of trouble and confusion. Why is that the case? Well, men have more trouble with it than women, as you might expect, because when you're already living in a more masculine expression of love by being physically alive, that the energy part of it dominates more than the astral or emotional side of it. And instead of wanting to express love by giving what others need, the tendency for all people, but men in particular, is to take love for the needs of ourselves rather than to give love for the needs of others. We get confused in this, and it creates problems for us. Taking energy from others, since this is now mostly sexual expression, or it's always colored to some extent by sexual expression, if it's a love that is intimate and what we would call romantic. In other words, it's a combination of the feeling part of energy with the feeling part of emotion together. That's what sexual love is, actually. And so when we have this condition in us, it produces some serious problems, but more so for men, because men don't have as sensitive an apparatus to the feminine side while they're physically alone as women do. And so they tend to exaggerate it even worse. And so men tend to seek a more selfish love that is represented more by sexuality than women do. And it takes some working on yourself, if you're a man, to discover this issue and to correct it by seeking to want to give love, especially under sexual circumstances, to a woman for her sake and benefit rather than for the man's sake. Even if the man in other ways loves the woman, the sexual side is dominated by this enigma. Interesting. I find that fascinating in itself. Now, let me go on with the physics of love, because this is, to me, this is like learning love from the inside out rather than, as we usually do, kind of through feelings and expressions that are more poetic and lacking, we'll say, science, and therefore inaccurate. Now, I'm not taking anything away from the poetic aspects of love. It really should be there. But because it's so dominant, we need to kind of maybe pay a little less attention tonight to that, because everybody kind of has a feeling for it. But try to examine the parts of love that are most confusing to people and that don't make a lot of sense, especially while we're physically alive. And it's the mistakes that people make in this, which I'm going to be talking about after the break, this first break in a few minutes, that is why there's so much suffering, why you, those of you out there, are maybe having problems in relationships with people, and why people of the same sex who are homosexual may have a lot of problems, why people who don't get the difference between the sexual element of love and the non-sexual elements of love, and why those get confused and problematic, and why those can become, at different times in relationships, at odds with each other. This happens sometimes right from the beginning, particularly in people who are more novice, at least in this lifetime, at trying to deal with love, feelings of love, especially adolescents and young adults, have a great deal of trouble with the expression of sexual love and the feelings of love outside of sexuality. And sometimes the two become literally contradictory to each other. Now, if you're past that stage, you may understand it. Some of you shaking your head, yeah, oh yeah, I know what he's talking about. But if you're in it, it's like bewilderment. So if you're probably younger than 28, some of what I'm saying may be like, yeah, I kind of have that problem, but I still can't figure out what the heck's going on with it. And if you're past it, you may say, oh, he's going to talk about that tonight, is he? Yeah, some of that I'm going to discuss, because this really does have a tremendous effect on the nature of our whole civilization, because so many people get married before 28 years of age, and those are the most conflicted relationships, and they may not survive. part of it has to do with the physics of love. How do you like that? And you thought tonight was just going to be about science. Now I'm going to be talking about practical things, as I usually do, after the first break. So all this stuff, the science stuff, you know, I go heavy on it in the beginning, scare off some listeners. They're probably all running for the, you know, okay, get me away from this guy. 10 minutes of what he's saying is I'm finished, you know. But it's just really, I realize that if I say it early in the show, I may lose some listeners, but it's when everybody is fresh enough they can understand it at some level. And then I'll get on to the more practical things, which are a little easier to understand. And they seem a little more intuitive than what I talk about in the beginning. I got it. I understand. I know some of you have complained about that even. Okay. So, let me continue now with that nasty, more scientific viewpoint. We move on to the astral world. It kind of reverses, which is cool. The feminine side becomes more dominant in the love aspect. Sexuality becomes easier, strangely, for men because they aren't dominated and reinforced so strongly by the process of understanding their sexuality and sexual expression of love with other elements of love that permits them to then find a better balance. They may be more expressive in numerous ways and literally more virtuous in their expression to women, meaning that they're focused more on women and the needs of women in the astral world once they're physically dead than they were while they were physically alive. Women, on the other hand, have a very strange response in the astral world, and I speak somewhat from experience here, and that is that the consciousness element grows in both women and men, so they both become a bit more virtuous. And the woman finds herself in a position where what was secondary, and usually she was subservient to the male's dominant aspect because of the intelligent activity issue and the energy issue in the physical world, now becomes, it goes away. And the woman becomes truly more equal in those elements of expression of sexuality. And there's a better balance, certainly, between women and men. But there, within the woman herself, the relationship to her own sexuality is more, we'll say, assertive and more of a, we'll say, equal to the male's tendency to dominate. So women tend to take on a stronger role. Now, if you have read Afterlife Love, you may have remembered that the characters in Afterlife Love who went to the various astral subworlds did discover that the women were more equal and dominant in their sexuality. You may not have noticed that in reading it, or you may have noticed that, because that's the truth. That's the way it is. And so you have a sexuality that is more equal and probably more virtuous on average. Now, with people, when they're expressing homosexuality, the roles are more similar to each other, whereas in the physical world, there's a dissimilarity involved, which causes a lot of oddity in the expression of sexuality in homosexual people. Let me give you an example there. In the physical world, usually one partner becomes more dominant and the other one becomes more submissive. The reason for this is that one is taking on a more masculine role, the other one is taking on a more feminine, because this is the nature of the physical expression of sexuality, and they're kind of rolling with it. Not because they're trying to be virtuous, necessarily, but it's actually easier for them to express, with less forces involved in the process, sexuality that way. In the astral world, if people are continuing to be, or choose to be in either case, homosexual, then each can express themselves and will not find the desire, emotional desire, to have a male-female or dominant-submissive relationship in a sexual sense as much as they may have had if they practiced homosexuality while they were physically alive. So it's a kind of interesting difference between the averages now. That doesn't mean there aren't people who do either in the opposite way than what I just said in either of the two worlds. It's just that on an average, this whole thing changes around, again, because the physics of love has changed. And it's just how moving energy and changing energy really changes with the physics of the world that you're in. And so it affects the expression of people. Fascinating stuff, huh? Well, so far we've been doing pretty good. It looks to me, because I haven't heard anything from Seth yet, that we are sustaining ourselves, and apparently I have a glitch on my board. And for right now, at least I've got three more places that I can put everything, and as long as I can use one of those three places, we won't have a problem. I think this board does have a defect in it, though. Too bad for the board, but better for us because we're using it in a way which is working, which is great. All right, so let me continue moving on, and hopefully I'm coming through loud and clear. When we move on from the astral world to the monastic or mental world, you're back into a more masculine spin of that dimension, a greater tendency for there to be an expression in more masculine energy, but the energy is no longer dominated by energy, by intelligent activity or energy, but it is dominated by choice. Because the first part of God's mind becomes more dominant than the third part in the mental world, especially once you get off the seventh subplane of the mental world. And this is a good thing because it helps people to become more virtuous. They can literally, through most of their will, choose consistently to express themselves in a more loving way. It's harder to do that while you're physically alive, especially if you're a male, because your senses aren't very accurate. They're illusioned, and they provide you with a wrong understanding, wrong consciousness, a lowered consciousness of the nature of love and the nature of sexual expression of love as well. So in the mental world, most people that get there, especially after they've been in the seventh subworld for a while, and beyond that, after they leave the seventh subworld for one of the higher ones, usually the sixth, the fifth, during that time, they correct most of the problems that they had in their illusions about what love is, and what particularly sexual love is, and how they can become more virtuous in the expression of it. They're starting to think more of as a soul than as a person. They still have a personality, but it is not dominating them the way it did while they were physically alive, or even astrally alive. And so this is the place, the lower mental world, is the place where people start getting things right, if they haven't already by the time they leave the astral world for life. So it's a pretty cool thing. It's a pretty interesting thing that there is, overall, a correction to the nature of this complicated problem of love and sexuality. And it really helps in each lifetime for a human being to get it right as early as possible. The best time to get it right is right here now. If you can get this whole thing correct, and hopefully tonight's show will help you, this is why I'm doing this show, then it makes your life a lot better while you're physically alive and moves you into a place so when you do get to the astral world, you may have a superlative ability to be loving and especially sexually loving. So this is really cool. This is really good. One of the things that most people don't know but they can grasp or discover is the best way to be in a sexual relationship is with monogamy. Now you might say, why is that the case? I know some of you think that, why can't I love the person I'm with? You know, But when I'm with somebody else, I can love them. And the reason is that love is so intense. It requires, especially sexual love, it requires such a focus of energy that learning how to do it with just one person is an incredible feat. It is not done the first time you're going to be sexual with somebody. It may not be done the first 1,000 times you're sexual with somebody. It requires incredible practice and discipline and consciousness to achieve, because love and consciousness are the same thing. And sexual love requires consciousness applied to activity. And it's difficult for consciousness to control activity. Activity has its own wanting to do its own thing, and consciousness has trouble on its own controlling it. And so the results are that if you start saying, well, okay, I'll love this person this minute, and tomorrow I'll love somebody else, you never get to the point where you're getting very close to even a fraction of the time, if you're sexually expressive with that person, with people, I should say, that you're able to get it right. You're able to get most of your energy to be focused on what the needs are of the other person in receiving the energy, helping them to identify their own sexuality and their own sex within themselves correctly, and making them a more whole and beautiful person. To do that requires just incredible levels. And if you're doing it with a bunch of people, you're never going to get it right with any of them. And so you have a hollow kind of relationship with each, missing the great intensity that comes from getting most of the energy moving towards the one person in the right way, so that it helps develop their consciousness, their identity, their sexuality, their needs, instead of your own. That's what your focus is on. Of course, they're supposed to be doing the same in return with you, so you're not losing anything. It's just that you're becoming more like the other person, and they're becoming more like you. And you eventually would, over time, if you did it perfectly, become them. So instead of feeling your feelings, you would feel theirs first, and then yours, and vice versa. And that may sound like a weird-out kind of thing, and some people might say, I don't know if I want to do that. Well, you can think about it, because we're going to go to break in another minute here. But before we go to break, I want you to realize that ultimately, this is what the goal is, whether it's during sexual exchange of energy or at other times when you may not be sexual with somebody, or if they're not going to be a sexual person to you. That's removing an important element in the relationship, but for other reasons, people don't necessarily always have sexual relationships and with someone. And so, in any case, it allows you to get out of yourself and become and feel eventually and experience life from the perspective of another person. This is what sexuality really is, and it's what love is in a wider sense. Wow. I want you to think about that. And we're going to take a break now. Hopefully everything is going to be copacetic when we come back. And we'll talk a lot more about some of these things I've been discussing, and then I'm going to go into all the practical issues about how this is affecting us, I mean, in huge ways, all the time. So we will be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. I was just telling Seth, our engineer, that this is a plug-and-pray board for me because I don't understand all of the buttons and settings on the board. I'm fairly familiar with some elementary things about electronics and hi-fi and that sort of stuff. When it comes to soundboards, this is a real sophisticated one. There's a lot of things I don't know about, and it would be good if I could learn about them because I'm not sure I have the settings right or anything. I just got to move everything around until it sounds okay. All right, so we're back, and we're talking about the physics of love. And this may sound like a very dry show, but it won't be by the end of the show, I guarantee that. So here we got an interesting element that most of what human beings experience as love really has to do with physics and metaphysics together. And metaphysics is just a physics beyond what we understand. For most people's understanding, it's the more hidden part of physics, sometimes the esoteric parts of physics. And so there's both physics and metaphysics involved with love because there's a hidden part to it. And this show deals a lot with those hidden parts, even though we sometimes deal with the physics as well, just the regular physics, which is kind of more contained and confined. All right. So, when we are looking at the three dimensions that human beings live on, and we're trying to understand love from those three dimensions, we are really talking about a kind of, we'll say, a kind of unity to the three dimensions themselves that allows us to, at some point, discover the nature of who we are, who others are, and eventually by comparing those to who God is. Most people think that relationships are strictly there for their entertainment, enjoyment, and otherwise not being lonely feelings, whereas what they really are there for is the discovery of our Creator. So when we think of sexual issues, which is the completion of love, or it should be, I'm not saying it is for most people, but it should be that. The result is that it's really a stepping stone to God. And isn't that interesting? It's also why, in the present day, human beings are almost obsessed with the love element to knowing people, and especially the sexual love issue as a centerpiece in their life. This becomes, for many people, an issue. Now, some of you know that in some sects of certain religions, they don't believe that people who are close into the sect should get married or have sexual relations because They should be able to directly understand God without the help of the sexual component, which they feel gets in the way. There may or may not, that may or may not be a true thing. I think it does diminish one's ability to use all of the, we'll say, arsenal in understanding God. And it takes away an important element. It may allow someone who's very devoted to understanding God and to God to focus on the other parts. And so I won't say one good, bad, or indifferent for those who choose that. It just makes it more difficult on an average than not. But if they can achieve it, all the more power to them. For the rest of us, this is a big issue, though. And so our lives tend to focus around it. Our medium elements, like where we are expressing elements of love that in our life through reading, poetry, movies, plays, stories, this is a big deal for us. And it's more so than it was thousands of years ago, because we have gotten more developed in our monastic side. And as we develop the monastic side, it gets closer to the willful or consistent choosing, to be more loving in our life than it was, say, for humans thousands of years ago. Because those folks did not seek, on an average, as much in a willful way to be more loving in their life than people do today. So it's kind of an interesting thing. They may have been controlled more by their emotions in some circumstances, which you might think makes them more loving, but it really doesn't. The balance of the mental, astral, and physical elements of being a human is a critical feature that determines whether or not we experience God more and become more virtuous. So we should be more virtuous today than we were on an average 1,000 years ago, or 1,500, 2,000, etc. Because, again, everything else being equal, people from the same region of the world, same kind of overall societal development, etc., should be more developed today than they were, provided that they have been somewhat successful in the past. Now, the way most folks try to live their life and incorporate love in it, be it love for children, love for family, love for friends, love for all different people in their life, love for God, of course, and under that, the sexual love. The way they tend to bring this together for themselves is by how they feel. So if someone says, gee, I feel love for someone, they make a note of it, and then they respond to that feeling. Now, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with someone necessarily doing that, depending upon their overall mental development. But as we develop ourselves more mentally, we would like to be more encouraging of our choices so that we regulate ourselves to be more loving to all people and be very loving to those that we understand the most, where we can make the fewest mistakes in focusing our energies and not wasting them, and where we can help others by our love, the best. And so this is the guidelines that would be good to be using and that usually bring about the closest relationship we have with God, our Creator, and to making the world more enlightened or virtuous. Living a virtuous life or an enlightened life is really the ultimate goal. And love is one of the three ways that we can achieve it in the easiest and best way possible. When people are focused emotionally the most on love and aren't using their thinking process, the mental thinking process in the system. Usually what happens is they overly dominate their giving on a feeling basis, which unfortunately is prone to be illusioned by their own desires. And that type of illusion causes those folks, which is all of us to some extent, very few of us are not, don't have desires to contaminate the whole process of our loving. It leads us away from being loving in the best way, the most often, with the most number of people, to being loving with those where oftentimes we are unusually selfish because we desire to get something back in the process. And then God to us becomes a kind of God who functions under the same basis. Well, let me explain that. You discover God by how you love. If you love in a way that has a lot of selfishness connected to your own feelings, which is controlled by your desires, dominated by feelings. It's okay to have feelings. You don't want to have feelingless love, but it needs to be balanced with your activities and your willful, controlled thinking. And if you don't have a balance in that way, and you just go by your feelings, you start seeing God from an emotional angle itself. In other words, God is a being who loves us back when we're good, when we do things that God says He wants from us, when we are more or less in a childlike sense doing what we think God wants for us, and then we're rewarded for doing that. That is not God. But it is a reflection of our own desires, and it does come from, unfortunately, a state of what is known as being glamored. And that glamour can grow all the way to being what we perceive as God, and therefore many religions have elements in them. Some of them are dominated by these elements of God, an emotive being that, instead of having an astral nature that is conditioned love, has a nature that is based upon elements that are conditioned love of our own desires, which is a reflection of what we desire. And since God actually desires unconditional love with us and everyone, a universally applied unconditional love is inconsistent with a conditional astral kind of love that is controlled by glamours. And it leads to a very different outcome. God loves so that all things can create themselves, grow more of themselves, and help others to do the same so that all can discover what God is and contribute to the growth of God while continuing to grow themselves at the same time. But a God that is like our own desires and feelings coming from those desires, which is called glamour or illusion, astral illusion love, is a God that would be just like those desires. And that God would be a God that feels best about us when we are obeying its needs and wants and growing what it wants for us instead of growing what is best for all others. And then we are basically becoming like little junior puppets to some kind of imagined God. And then it's easier for, unfortunately, folks that claim to be the emissaries of God, the priests, the bishops, whatever, to tell us what to do and for us to follow them, etc. So if, unfortunately, these kind of religious viewpoints come from people themselves who want to be in power over other people, and that's not a good thing. So it's an abused thing, an abused element of illusion that's astral. Scary stuff. Very scary. All right, so we've got quite a bit to change about ourselves because the majority of people are contaminated by these kind of false but still religious ideas that have a lot to do with love. And that causes people to run astray when they get into relationships, be it sexual or parental or familiar of any way, to some element of a boss and an employee or a friend, close friend, distant friend, acquaintance, just people we run into every day. It affects all of those kinds of relationships, which could be very loving, but have distortions in them. Distortions that are accentuated and built upon how religions in general, we say, reinforce it. So a heavily religious person may be a person that has a lot of this baggage. And even if you're not religious, you can have the same baggage, but you come to the conclusions not from someone else encouraging you to necessarily, but just based upon your own desires. Either way, it can lead to some real problems. Okay, so I just want to, I'll stop for a second, let's all think about all that stuff, and we'll come back to it in a couple minutes. I just want to say hello to Eric, if he's listening. Are you listening out there, Eric? And if you are, Eric works over at the Wells Fargo Bank in the Fry's store, not too far from where I from where I live and work. And he's a nice fellow. And he works as a, I don't even know what his official title is, but he's a kind of junior banker, I'm sure. He's a guy who helps you as in customer service and does a lot of stuff then. Is interactive between the bank and individuals. Makes his job more interesting. He's not just working with money, giving people money and stuff, but he's working with parts of the bank and what they how they relate to people. And he's a nice fellow. And if you're in that area, this is in the Tempe area, you can go visit him. He's at the Fry store over in Southern and Rural. Right on a corner there. And you can go visit him and say, hello, hi, I heard you're on the radio, you're a nice guy, and you can open up an account for me or do whatever. One of the things I like about the bank he works for, which is Wells Fargo Bank, is right now at least, they aren't charging any fees for all these various services that some other banks are doing. If you haven't come across it yet, you may this month, because some banks in the U.S. now are charging for everything. I mean, like, you name it, they charge you for it, you know. They're charging you to put money in, take money out, say hello, say goodbye. You know, just every kind of activity they're charging for. And this particular bank, Wells Fargo, is not charging so much as many for as many things. So you can still use a debit card without getting charged for that. You can write a check without getting charged for that. Or a bunch of other things. You make deposits, withdrawals, no charge. That's better than a lot of other banks. Now you might ask, well, why are banks doing that? Well, it's because our government decided that everything is the bank's fault that the government told the banks they had to start doing about 10 years ago. And when the government for 10 years ago intervened and said, you got to start doing this because poor people don't own enough houses, they don't have enough wealth, they don't have enough credit, so we want you to lessen these standards, to increase these services, and do all this because that'll help us get reelected and other stuff. And so the banks said, well, if you pass the laws, we must obey. And so they passed the laws, the government people did, our representatives, and Congress people and president eventually. And so this got to the point where people were being given credit who shouldn't have credit because they don't understand how to use it properly, and they abuse it. People bought houses they couldn't afford. They rented or leased or bought cars they couldn't make payments on, and they got a lot more credit cards than they could handle in debt, and they tried to maintain a lifestyle that they weren't deserving because they didn't have enough consciousness to grow themselves into the ability to earn the living necessary for the lifestyle they wanted to live. So they just used credit cards to make up for the difference. And eventually the credit card debts got up to, you know, 1, 2, 3 times their annual salaries, which is almost impossible to pay off because the credit cards have very high interest rates, partly coming from the fact that more and more people were defaulting on them. And it became a vicious circle. Higher interest rates, more defaults, and more high interest rates, creating more defaults. But the worst part of the problem got going when you ended up with so many houses bought by so many people who didn't have correct credit to buy them, but the government said, you banks shouldn't be looking at all that credit, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, just approve their loan and let them go. They should all have houses. Okay, whether you afford them or not, we'll worry about that 5 years from now. But give them loans that start them off with extremely low rates. In a few years, they're starting to pay ridiculous amounts, and they can't possibly pay for the house. And so that's what happened. And then, of course, we all know what took place. We went into a recession. The economy fell apart. And Wall Street banks started selling packaged loans filled with creditors of housing, you know, owners of houses who couldn't pay their mortgages. So the mortgages were no good, but they traded them like they were gold. And when you got nothing in place of gold, you got a lot of trouble. And that's what the society fell apart of. That, along with the credit card debt and everything else, led to a massive failure of banks. And now, with the recovery issues, which are not working very well due to socialistic principles, we're in an even worse problem because, in some sense, while we don't have quite as many people owning houses who can't afford them, because a lot of them have lost them already, the remaining people who are trying to hang on are doing so with a lower and lower standard of living overall, because they're just trying to pay for a house they can't afford. And so, in order for the banks to stay in business, they started charging for things that are absurd. Like, oh, you want to put money in the bank? We'll charge you for that. You want to take money out of the bank? We'll charge you for that. You want us to hold the money for you? We'll charge you for that. Matter of fact, if you want to get online and look at your account, this is true of some banks, we'll charge you for that. All right, so a lot of people are getting upset about all those charges. And the bank's responses are, well, it's a good thing to do because it's the only thing we can do because the government just came in with new rules. What are the new rules? Well, the new rules are you can't be a bad bank by making loans to people who don't have enough credit that's proven and enough money. But isn't that where the bank started? And it was the government that forced them through a thing called community response, et cetera, to loan money to people, forced them to loan money to people that they shouldn't be loaning money to. So who's the real blame? Who has the real blame? Government. That's where it started. That's an unfortunate problem, a very big unfortunate problem. I'm starting to hear some noise on this line here. I don't know where it came from. I'm going to turn this down, see if I can make it better. Yeah, I have no idea where it just suddenly popped in there from nowhere. I heard it this time. Did you have to take me off? All right, I heard some static there. I heard the engineer come in and say something to me. And we put me back on, and I made another adjustment on the board. So we're continuing to go on. Hopefully this is all going to work out okay. I'll do everything I can so that I can stay on talking to y'all. So anyway, all this aside, which is a little lesson in economics, the good news is there's still some banks trying to hang in there and not overcharge people. And one of them happens to be Wells Fargo, so that's where I happen to be banking at the present moment. And stop by and say hello to old Eric. If he's still listening, he's probably laughing his whatever, because he's saying, wow, that was quite a commercial for my bank. Yeah, it was. Okay, back to what I was talking about. Love, 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 love. Yeah. And I hope, by the way, I hope this adjustment I just made will solve our problem. Getting back to how is it that people get so fouled up? Let's talk about some of the issues that start happening. The practical side of the physics of love. To begin with, our nature is to sense with the body that we are in consciousness in, which is where we call ourselves to be alive. So if you're physically alive, the body that you're physically alive in is the dominant body that you listen to your senses in. You still have feelings, which are astral, and you still have mental thoughts and mental feelings, believe it or not, mental senses, I should say, that tell you something about those thoughts. But that stuff is so, so far from the dominance of our physical senses that it's hard for us to get out of our physical senses most of the time. Women can sense a little bit more emotionally, a little more with their astral body than men can, because they, by nature, are more feminine, and the astral body is more feminine. Men have a very rough time with this. It's more difficult to love, in general, and be a man than it is a woman. That's just if you're physically alive. Okay, so, during our childhood, we learned something about parentalness. We learned something about being parental, because we are being parented. And we learn something, therefore, about what it means to be a parent and learn how to parentally function with love. This is a key factor, really, to the development of the love that we have. So many people think that they learn about parenting when they have children. You know, like, oh, gee, I had a child, I was 30 years old. No. You don't learn about parenting when you have a child. You learn about parenting when you are one. There's a poem. It goes, children learn what they live. I love that poem because it's so true. And I was getting some more noise on it. I can hear it. I'll see if I can make some adjustment on this board. Something I'll do here. Okay, so when we have a process that we're going through when we're young, of learning what it means to be a parent. But we're dominated by our physical senses, and so it's the interaction of energy and form between our parents and ourselves that tells us about love. If we don't receive the needed kinds of physical things in our life and the energy from our parents while we're young, we don't understand, we learn not how to love in a parental way when we're older. This becomes most difficult for children that are oftentimes poor. And so they're more prone to this sort of problem. And they keep... Well, I'm getting some noise. I'll turn it down some more. They may... still getting some more noise on the line. Try to turn it down a little more. They may sometimes find that because there is so little available coming from their parents, the parents have to make up for some of the deprivation of physical things with the expression of energy from themselves. But they may, because they are struggling so much, turning down my board even further, because they're struggling so much that they cannot find a way to, okay, I'm still testing my board here, they cannot find a way to make up for that which is missing in a material sense to their children. Once that starts to happen, unfortunately, the child may not learn how to properly love. So there is some difficulty if you have a wanting society, a society in which a lot of people don't have much materially, because children can suffer. The parents spend a lot of time just trying to gain the sense of life. And they don't understand they have to make up for what's lacking in a physical sense with their own emotional energies towards their children. And if they don't do that, the results are the child becomes a bad parent. But also, in becoming a bad parent, they become less connected to God, and they may be less successful in life in general. And they may become less able to earn a living. And so you can see a pattern developing. This is the most unfortunate part of existence. And you can see this happening in many different kinds of societies throughout the world. Now, what can we do about that? Well, part of it is in education, especially if you have public education available. That public education, at little or no cost to children, can make up for some of the differences and help people to understand what they need to do in a correct way and help the child to learn love coming as a educated element to both their parents and through the school system so that it can make up for some of the problems of deprivation. When we are beyond the stage of the formative years, say beyond 14 years of age, it becomes very difficult to make up for a lack of loving parental understandings from a younger age. You can do it, again, with education, discipline on the person's part. But they may not ever be as good a parent as they might have become. So this is definitely an issue, and one that many parts of our society suffer from. The family is a critical element in the development of all of society. And I don't think this is recognized, unfortunately, as it should be. It's most difficult because of the high levels of deprivation that can occur here in the physical world, where it's so hard to even maintain what we would consider to be a standard of living. And governments can hurt the situation by trying to control it, and by controlling it in ways that, instead of being truly loving, is actually an intrusion into the ability.
Hi, this is Niles McFlower for the new show, Why Life Is, right here on Friday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Now on BBS Radio, Why Life Is answers a vast number of questions and explores the demystifying of metaphysics and spirituality. Just a fraction of what we will cover are such subjects as detailed explanations of the afterlife, what the meaning of life is, and what intelligent life is like in other worlds. This is a show many of you have been waiting for to hear and participate in as well. Why Life Is has been on the air broadcasting for nearly 3 years and is now available on BBS Radio in prime time on Friday nights at 7 p.m.
Okay, we're trying it again. I'm back online, and hopefully you can hear me. I'm going to be watching this. I need someone in here. Yeah, would you watch this very carefully? And if you see anything jump up, a little red, come on there, then let me know. I'm talking to somebody here in the studio with me. We have still problems with the equipment. We just don't know where they are, but I made some more adjustments on the board, and I will continue to try to do the show as best as I can. All right, so deprivation can lead to poor parenting because it takes such greater effort if you're in a deprived environment to produce a loving effect with children. You can do it. You can be the poorest family on earth and still have a loving environment. It's just more difficult. And especially this is true in the physical world. This is where the tests are of this sort of thing. So the children learn an incomplete way of parenting, and that then leads to a kind of cycle of them becoming less successful in life because they lack love. And with the lack of love, you're deficient in part of God. When you're deficient in part of God, you have a directionless life. You may be creative, but your creations don't turn out to be very much successful, and life becomes, again, a drudgery and lacking meaning. And so for those folks, they, again, then have more children in their future who they find it difficult to love correctly. So this is a real big problem, and if caught in this problem, I would strongly suggest that you solve it by first getting some education. You need to compensate in yourself for your own lack of love and to find ways to give to your children in ways that compensate for their lack or the deprivation of various things like food, shelter, clothing, etc., to help them get through the formative years so they can become better parents as they grow older. Now, the foundation of love is this parenting element, and we don't recognize this. We don't understand it very well. And then, after 14, you start developing the sexual component. Now, some people say, well, I was sexual when I was 10. You know, that's fine, no problem. There is some sexuality at all ages. But I'm saying when you reach 14, it becomes a big deal. That's on an average. And it grows into a higher and higher peak as you move past 14. So it is, at that point, the sexual component coming in, where the hormones are raging, et cetera, that a more, that the now you're adding a layer onto the original component and how you might have found God through parental love and through love back from the child to the parent. Now you're adding into this part about givingness on the sexual side. And when that is taking place, if the parental side is weak, then the sexual side becomes weakened from the foundation of the parental. And so people become sexually selfish instead of sexually loving. You need to have a balance. Okay, I already am seeing stuff go goofy here on the board. I'm going to turn this down more, see if that does anything. So strange, because it's like the longer I'm on the air, the goofier this board gets. When I go off the air, it sort of recovers itself, and then, bingo, it's working again. Okay. I'm going to continue. Oh, there it goes again. I'll see if it can calm itself down here so I can stay on the line. See, if this board starts going crazy, it screws up the board on the other side where the engineer is, and they can't maintain the volume correctly. All right. I will continue now. I'm looking at the board as I'm doing this, giving it a chance to recover itself. Pay more attention to the board than the show. My God, this is something else here. Let me try this. Turn this down further. Okay. See if that does anything. So, if we're going to have a person develop in a normal fashion, once they get to the sexual stage, they need to be unselfish. They need to want to give in their sexuality rather than to take. And this is hard to do because in the beginning of the development of sexuality, the person is flooded with very, very strong feelings that are controlled by desires. Their desires become the real motivating factor in initiating sexual response rather than, we'll call it the opposite of desire, the love or desire to give to others. And they have to learn gradually, usually, to reverse this desire they have to fulfill themselves and to feel good to wanting to fulfill someone else and help them to feel good. This is a difficult process. It usually takes several years or longer to achieve. Theoretically, it's supposed to be done in 7 years, but by the seventh year, you should be pretty good at it. But that isn't the way it necessarily is. Now, you don't have to be sexually active to have this happen. This is something that goes on inside of you. Being sexually active may or may not improve the results, but it's about what's going on inside that's so critical. All right, so let's examine this process. What goes awry? Well, the first thing that usually happens that goes awry is that there's a lack of, again, of education, usually coming and starting from the home, about this process. The best thing you can do is to try to explain it and help youngsters who are still adolescents to understand what's going on and to realize that this energy that they have now to exchange with others is a gift to be used to help others to understand themselves, be closer to God, to become more giving themselves, rather than just a gift to make yourself feel good because it in some way gives you excitement and you like that. The excitement can still be there at some level, but the excitement is for the other person first. And it comes back to you when the other person does the reverse. Then you start learning to only be or be around people who are as loving as you are, and you don't make the mistake of, quote-unquote, falling in love with someone who is below your level of consciousness significantly and much more selfish, because then you have an imbalance in your relationship. One person is taking, the other one is giving, and that usually doesn't work very well. Or you may have both people taking, which certainly is prone to disaster. It almost always ends up in a stale and meaningless any kind of long-term relationship. It also leads to failed marriages, particularly if they occur during this developmental period from 14 to 21. Most marriages below those ages, below the age of 21, are not going to have a high success rate. It doesn't mean all aren't, but it means a lot won't. And from 21 to 28, there's another whole period of mental loving that a person needs to develop. This is what encourages a real balance in the love. As I explained in the first part of the show, this is what balances the physics of love, so that instead of it just being based upon how energy is moving, either in a sexual sense or in a parental sense, it becomes much more based upon or on feelings, and whether you feel good or don't. You don't feel good, because it's much more based upon your choice to be closer to your creator through becoming one with another who is wanting to do the same. So spiritual relationships then grow into spiritual loving relationships and into becoming really close together, at the same time being closer to God at the same time. That's a successful relationship. That may not occur until after age 28. It takes about another 7 years, from 21 to 28, before people learn that part of love through a more mental awakening, through an understanding that's much higher than the feeling level of the astral nature of people. When you can get that going, that's a big deal. And that can help in many ways to successfully achieve a, we'll say, real bonding that can be a lifelong bonding with another, because you learn monogamy, you learn that the exchange of love energy, both sexually and non-sexually, and in raising children, if that's what you're going to be doing, all involves being closer to God. So now you're on a totally different spiritual course. You have a spiritual relationship as well as a physical, emotional, and mental relationship, one that can grow indefinitely throughout the rest of your life here in the physical world. And in theory, could continue on to the astral and mental worlds on a soul level more if you leave the physical world within a short time of each other. So there's a wealth of understanding that can come from just this understanding of the physics of love. And if we become attuned to it, we can develop much more meaningful, successful, tremendously fulfilling lives, have much greater fulfillment in raising families and in doing co-service in a spiritual sense with those that we love, and especially those that we love in a sexual sense, but not only. This is true even if you remove the sexual component. The same factors apply to all those who love one another and serve together in any fashion. So this don't think that this is just about, I'm talking about the one person you're going to be a mate with. No, I'm talking about everybody. And especially people like working in spiritual groups or co-serving in any fashion whatsoever. You know, a lot of people say, well, I'm a humanitarian. I want to give with others to the world. Great. Fantastic. Then you have a loving relationship with those that you are giving if you really have a spiritual foundation in that giving. But in order to maintain that for any significant length of time, requires going through these steps that I'm discussing. You can say, well, what about that parental thing if you're doing giving to the world? Well, the world then is your children. All of the people you give to become, you become the super parent to them. And you get to know God through your service to the world. That's fine. There's no problem with that. Matter of fact, people who are doing that oftentimes do not have children because they have superseded that aspect of how they want to give, and they want to do it on a much more widespread scale. That doesn't mean you can't have both. Everything is a choice in your life, and you can create it to be in exactly the fashion that you want. It's not a problem. All right, so the interesting element to this is that we live our lives with one of the most key elements, the key aspect, being understood, not taught, not well thought about, not significantly meditated on, with almost no written place to go to understand it, except for some of the stuff I've written, of course, but very little out there, except for mostly things that are sentimental, which means overly affected by how we feel, as far as the way we think, and has folklore and romanticism and a lot of, we'll say, emotionalism as its foundation. And everybody thinks they understand what love is, and in fact, they have almost no understanding at all. Okay. What are some of the ways we can correct some of this stuff? Because after all, we all want to be better at loving, right? I hope. Well, one of the things that is important is if you're, I assume most of my listeners are already at the adult level. Many of you are beyond the age of 28. And you may or may not be very successful at some of the things that I'm talking about. If you're not successful, then it is incumbent to make a change because not only are you going to be miserable in your life and possibly make other people miserable who supposedly are close to you in your life, but your very reason for existence is to be here to grow to become more a part of God, and that would make your life much more meaningful, but instead it becomes tedious, boredom, and hostile with great forces, crises one after another, and other forces that are delivered because of your level of selfishness related to your ability to give. So your ability to give in comparison to how selfish you are says how responsible you are or are not in your life, and that determines how much force you're going to have in your life, which people sometimes refer to as karma. So it's a negative karma, actually. So it's something that we actually can change. Once you get it defined and once you realize what you're doing, you can make some changes about it, and you don't have to live the kind of life that you're maybe presently in, and you can move to a completely different level of existence. So, what are some of the things that we can do to make changes? The first is to see how much we are giving to help others to give versus giving to either get from others or not giving at all or just trying to take from others. That's the first level of assessment you need to take if you reach the point at least where you're maybe beyond 28 years old or so, and you think you're at the point where now you need to reassess who you are and what you're doing. So can you make these kinds of changes? Sure. After you get the assessment, all the areas of your life that you are not giving to help others to become wise, better givers themselves, but your focus is on something you need or want to get out of the situation, you need to sacrifice, get rid of the areas that you want to get something out of. Use the energy that you focused on in getting something to give, and to give to others that are truly givers themselves, and that you are trying to help become even more giving and to co-serve with. That's really the soul level that we're trying to reach now in being here in the physical world. Can you do this? Yes. How long would it take? For a lot of people, it's going to take many months to several or more years to make a significant change if they're caught in the selfish side of things. Is it possible, then, to make the change? Yes, but it does require an incredible level of sacrifice of those areas where people say they have desires. I want this, I want that. If I just have that, I'll be fine. If I just have this, I'll be fine. It doesn't work that way. It all goes by who you're helping to become more giving, and are you using your energies in the most responsible way you can for your abilities versus how much you are actually giving and co-serving with others. It's really based upon that. It's all a relationship issue. It's not about a specific number for all people, because everybody is different to some extent in this equation. When you get to the point when you realize how selfish you are, and I would write down all the areas you're selfish in, make a list. I like lists. They help. And then decide how you can change, what you need to give up, and what you need to become a lot more giving in, where your energies need to be refocused and changed, where your consciousness needs to be expanded so you can understand how to give more. And you can also use the feedback from other people as a guide. Not to say that they are necessarily going to be any more right than you are, but the difference here is that you're not listening for rightness or wrongness. You're listening for your own perspective to be challenged by that of many other people's. It helps to say, do you think I'm helping you to become better at giving, and see what a person says to you. You might be surprised at the responses you're going to get. They may be much more limited and negative than you would ever realize. You say, well, I've been giving that person this or that for a long time. I've been available, even if I haven't done anything. Well, you know what? That doesn't cut it. That doesn't work. It's more than being available. It means that you've got to really put yourself out there and do something. You may have to be proactive far more than active. Most people think that proactiveness is only required in almost life and death situations. And the rest of the time, they can just skate through life and let others supposedly demand upon them something before they'll consider even giving. Actually, if someone is demanding upon you, they may be caught in their own illusions, their own selfishness. And it's not really the point. Most of the time when people need help, they don't. They aren't asking for it. Most of the time when you're needed to be helpful and co-creative of God, God's not knocking on you and saying, hello there, are you going to give today? Actually, the less you get close to God, the less you can hear God, in a kind of liberal way of expressing God. I'm talking about your soul and your soul and angel, but still the same part, the same thing. So don't believe for a moment, because you aren't hearing anybody knocking on your door. They're not out there and not needing you. And you're not ignoring God, when you may be completely ignoring that. Because those kinds of excuses are the most abused ones. They're the ones that most people use most of the time in expressing why they're not giving more in a wise and helpful way so that others can become better givers themselves, and they aren't co-serving with others, therefore. Well, I'm not co-serving with anybody because nobody's come in and put a gun to my head and said, you got to go co-serve. So why should I go do it? I'm not being co-serving with anybody because nobody's coming to me and say, come and co-serve. Or giving me something first before I co-serve. That's what I really want. Now, that's a bunch of nonsense. That's a selfish person making excuses for their selfishness. All right. So, the list will help you. the feedback from others will help you. And the most important thing that will help you is our own compass of God itself. When we focus outside of ourselves and try to look on the inside, being that part of us that we believe God exists within, we can see ourselves truly. We can do this. You can do it. You may not like what you see. It may be quite uncomfortable. It may trouble you. Accept that, because that's the first part of change, is not liking who you are. It's like, indeed, I don't like that. That's disgusting. I don't want to be that. That's terrible. And you can make those changes. Okay, what else can you do? You can choose to change the structure of your life. Now, everything I said so far, it's more an inward journey. But there's an outward one, especially in the physical world, this is most critical. Who you associate with. What kind of activities you put yourself into. What is most of your day about? Is most of your day about meeting some of your needs? Is most of your day about getting some loneliness out of your life and feeling less lonely? Really? Is most of your day about making some more money? Is most of your day about getting some physical thing? Having more physical things? Having nicer physical things? If your thoughts are about that, you're living a life of materiality. You have a spiritually eroded foundation. And you're not seeing or finding God. You're leading a personal existence, not a soul existence. How do you challenge that? You restructure your life. Look for others who are co-serving and insist that you yourself put yourself out to do some co-service with those that you find are co-serving. It may not be directly in front of you. There may be some distance away or some other. But when you find them, you'll know them. And you want to co-serve with them, do it. Restructure your life. Say, I have this many minutes in a day. I'm devoting most of these minutes to this restructuring process of being in co-service with others and in working in a more spiritual way. This includes your spouse, hopefully, if you have one, your children, everybody. And as you restructure your life, some people may not go along with it. Your spouse might not. It's possible. You may lose your relationship with your spouse. So what? Do you want a relationship with God? Or do you want to have somebody who you have superficial sexual relationship with and are a poor parent with? And lack much of a coherent spiritual life. Now, I'm not saying everybody should run out and divorce their spouse, but if you find yourself in that position and your restructuring of your life leads to a totally different place, you give the other person an opportunity to come with you about it. If they choose not to, they choose not to. That's there for you to choose that. Not everybody's going to go where you want to go. But then you have to go boldly and somewhat fearlessly towards that which is real, towards your understanding of your own spiritual nature and where you're going to thrive in doing it. And it may not be with the ones and people that you have been with. It's possible. That's a very difficult thing to do. If your children aren't selfish, you need to work as hard as you can to try to change that, because you were the foundation of the selfishness to begin with. Children learn what they live. They got it from you, and only you can likely change it. So that's where it's got to come from. That's how the change comes through. This is a bitter pill for some people. What if you're evolve with people in a spiritual sense, but you find yourself faltering. What should you do? Look for people who serve less so that you can feel comfortable around them? Yeah. No. What you need to do is to communicate with the people that you're supposedly serving with and find out where you're faltering. Work very hard to become a better co-servant. Do all the things that I just said and exercise something called spiritual discipline rather than the more mundane disciplines that I've been discussing. And spiritual discipline means focusing on each one of your senses so that they become more and more attuned to the co-service with those that you serve with. It's a difficult process. And it means much greater levels of sacrifice than the more mundane elements. There was some spiritual service in everything I was saying just during this show so far, but this gets into much higher levels. And if you're into that, then that's what you need to do. Now, what if you don't do that? Well, first of all, you exclude yourself from the people who are serving. But besides that, the ultimate end of that is a meaningless life, which has great sorrow and tremendous forces and is destructive to yourself and the goals and needs of those who could be co-serving you. It's a bad situation, a bad outcome. You don't want that. And when you go on to the astral world, then you become mired in all kinds of problems. Whereas you want to leave this life so the astral world becomes a step up in consciousness, but a step down in your ability to improve the universe because you've lost the body and its senses, and now you're serving from two-thirds instead of all three bodies and senses. Well, let me quickly go through because we're running out of time here. The ultimate goal is to unify all three of the senses and bodies while we're physically alive and before we live the physical world, because this is where we can do the most amount of good, and we're here for a very short period of time relatively. So this is a great place, even though it's so difficult and so suffering at times, so disappointing at times. But you'll never have a greater opportunity than you have right now. Your opportunities will become less as you age here, and then far less when you leave here and go on to live in the astral, and then even less than that in the middle worlds, to make a difference in the whole universe. Even though you become more like your soul in every step of the way going back to your soul, because that's what this whole journey is, it doesn't help as much to become a brilliant soul-like being in the middle of your middle life when, while you were physically alive, you were totally irresponsible and you had almost a meaningless existence and you failed to spiritually discipline yourself if you're a spiritually developed person, or you failed to just raise your level of creating some light in your life, even if you're not yet on this fully spiritual path. This is where it all becomes a question of having the foresight and the fortitude to do things now instead of waiting for some later period in this life, or as many people do, that they go on to the astral world and then regret the time when they could have done the most and did so little. Final notes of what I'm talking about tonight. The physics of love tells us that love is the thing that people know or understand of the least, and that brings the most joy in their lives or the most sorrow, depending upon how they choose to understand and exercise it at each level of their existence. Hopefully, by the end of tonight's show, you will have realized that and decided to make some changes in who you are and how you're going to live your life and love in it. A lot more to talk about. I had to skip some parts of what I wanted to say tonight because of equipment problems. But I guess we made it to this part of the show, and whatever my settings are now seem to be not too bad. I'm going to have to get some different equipment, I'm afraid. This equipment seems to be on the way out. Okay, listen. Until next week, I want you all to think about everything I said in tonight's show. And this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.